I want to ask you a serious question. Do you feel a little stuck in your two-person scenes? Do you feel like you're doing the same scenes over and over again, like every scene you do is about a roommate? Well, if you answer yes, then I want to help. And the best way I know how to help you is by letting you know that I will be teaching my two-person scene tune-up one-day workshop on Saturday, December 30th, here in Chicago. I limit this to 14 people, so you get personal attention. To register or for more information, just go to my website at jimmycorain.com. Also, if you're a seasoned improviser, an actor, or new to improv, I just want to let you know I'll be starting my next Artist Low Comedy Level 1 class on January 10th at Green Shirt Studios here in Chicago. I also limit this to 10 people, so you get personal attention. And to register or for more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com.
Feral Audio.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Will Hines. He is the author of his new book, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth. If you don't know Will, he has taught and performed improv at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater since 2000. Before that, he was a computer programmer, which allowed him to figure out that he's performed more than 7,854 improv scenes on stage or in a classroom. And as a teacher coach, he's watched about 42,660. This is a great episode. It is filled with so much great information from the book. Will talks about what it's like to be present and be authentic in your improv scenes and how important that is to develop that muscle when you're first starting out. He also talks about what it's like to be brave and taking risks as an improviser. And we go into the game of the scene a little, which of course is synonymous with the UCB. If you're a teacher or an improviser, you're going to love his perspective on things. Will is one of the most thoughtful teachers, writers, improvisers out there. He puts a lot of thought and a lot of knowledge and passion and experience into his writing. And I really enjoyed this book a lot. And I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. Before we get to that, I just want to say, I miss you guys. Being this week off, you know, we're doing it every other week for a while. I miss doing this. And things are going good. Betsy is, she just turned 8 months yesterday, which is really, really super exciting. And Lauren's got her to laugh. And so is our nanny, Holly. She does this like juggling thing. And when Betsy laughs, it's really cute. She kind of goes, she makes this kind of sound, which is, I haven't made her laugh yet. So I think hopefully she's going to be as tough a laugh as I am. As you know, I don't laugh. I make people laugh. Isn't that beautiful? That's really, really beautiful. But it's been a little stressful today because Betsy didn't sleep. And also last night, we've had to, since having Betsy, Lauren and I haven't had as much sex, so we have to schedule it. So we were supposed to schedule a sex date. And I was just in a foul mood after therapy. It happens. About every 10 therapy group therapies, I come back and I'm just in a really depressed mood and trying to process everything. And that was last night. And that was on our sex night, which, of course, I don't want to bring up the next time in therapy because they're like, oh, isn't it funny that you were in a bad mood on the night you're supposed to have sex? Sounds like you're avoiding intimacy, which probably is totally true. But tonight, we're supposed to have a sex night. So we'll see if that works out. That's what you have to do when you have a kid. You got to schedule everything. It's just, and I'm not organized. Thank God Lauren is. So enough about me. You are going to love this episode. Not only does Will give you just so many great nuggets you can take away. We do some, you know, slight improvising to give you some examples. And I just love Will so much. Here it is, the Will Hines episode. Enjoy. Will Hines, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Oh, my pleasure, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. Now, in 1999, you're 29 years old, a computer,
that's right.
computer programmer, taking your first improv class at the UCB with no performance experience. Take us back to that first class and how you got hooked on improv.
This was Kevin Mullaney taught this class. It was a level one, and it was on the stage of the UCB Theater Monday nights. The UCB Theater was relatively new, so they didn't have shows every night. So Monday night they had classes in the theater. And, you know, I felt self-conscious about being older than everybody. And just excited to, you know, it was just like trying to do something new, like the computer programming world. My day job was so boring that I just was excited to be around creative people. And I just lucked out. My class, I made friends with them, and Kevin was such a good teacher that right away, you know, very soon into it, I was like, I'm going to do this for as long as I can.
And how did you go from being a shy person, because you describe yourself in your book as being a shy person, to being one of the most respected performers and teachers at the UCB in New York?
Well, I was shy, but I think I had a, you know, I was good about having a beginner's mind. Like, I was good about being humble. I was like, all right, I know I'm not good at this, and I'm just going to try to, like, get out of my own way and do what my teachers tell me and, you know, just through trial and error, figure out how to be less shy. I think, like, Being shy for me was just meant that I was scared that I wasn't liked. I was scared about the audience not liking me. And I got more comfortable with the idea that if you are yourself and you're honest, the audience will like you.
And you talk about that in your book. And in the first chapter, you call it, it's called Be Present. And yeah. That's the name of the chapter. And it seems to me that this is probably one of the most overlooked things in improv. And that is essentially to learn to be yourself on stage. Why is that so important for improvisers to just be themselves?
Yeah, I think it's it is overlooked because it's hard to do. It's one of those things that once you do it, it doesn't take a lot of effort. But until you have a feel for it, you're not quite sure if you're doing it or not, so it's hard. I bet you teach this a lot, Jimmy, because your class is called The Art of Slow Comedy, right? Or one of the things you teach is called that.
Yes, correct.
And I bet you going slow is one of the ways that helps you be more yourself, you know? If you slow down and just let yourself feel what you're feeling. It's hard to do, and I think it's so important because the audience can smell a faker. The audience can smell something that's untrue, and they don't like it. They want something that's authentic, and they know when you're being honest with them or not.
And what is one of the best ways to do that? In your class, when you teach, or in your book, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth, what is one thing people can do to tap into that that authenticity?
Some of it is don't try to race ahead. You know, the chapter's called Be Present. And I think one of the things you could do is don't worry about the ending or where it's going. If you think ahead to the end and you try to control the scene, you end up removing yourself from the scene and trying to like steer it and force it, and you worry about what it's looking like. So I guess one of the things to do is like just try to report the present moment. Just say what you're thinking or feeling as the character.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. So like if you and I start a scene and you start the scene that we're two people in cubicles next to each other and we're both typing in our computers. This is a little tricky. Rather than me trying to think of something amazing that could happen or something funny or something absurd, instead of doing that, try to like really be a good actor and be two guys in cubicles and try to kind of remember like what are the things you think and feel in that moment. You know, not something honest, not something big. You know, are you thinking about lunch? Are you thinking about who you have a crush on? Are you worried about the clothes you're wearing? And just say one of those things out loud, and you'll be like on the right path.
So what would be an example of a line?
So I might look at you. Mm-hmm. If you just initiate, you're typing at a keyboard, and I mirror you, and I'm typing at a keyboard. We're both, you know, I start thinking like, do I like this job or not? And I'm going to assume, not being given any other information, that I don't like this job, but that I don't want to get fired. And I'm a little antsy and I'm a little bored, and I'm feeling like I want to gossip about my coworkers. I'll look at you. You initiated, so I'm going to make sure that you don't have anything else coming. And if you don't, I might just lean over and kind of say like, you know, can you believe Lloyd? Can you believe Lloyd? Does he really expect us to like throw him a, you know, do we all have to sign that birthday card that Lloyd's passing around? You know, I'm just trying to pick something that really happens in offices. Everybody signs a birthday card.
And I could say something like, well, you know, why don't you just do it? I know you don't like him, but that's, you don't want to be a jerk.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm still trying to just be real and be in the moment. Like, I know I'm going to do it. I'm just going to sign it. I don't know. I wish I just didn't have to deal with it. You know, I wish I could just duck out of here and not even go to that party. Like how many cakes do we have to have at this office?
But the good thing about cakes is it breaks up the day. It's something to look forward to.
It's just, I don't know if it's worth it. The small talk is so fake. You know, you I can talk to, you I like. But like most of these people here, I wouldn't be friends with them. I don't like having to fake it. It takes a lot of energy out of me to like fake talking to someone I think is boring.
Well, I feel the same, but I'm afraid to express it at work.
Let's get out of here. Let's skip it. Let's just, you know, like at weddings, I always duck into the bathroom during like the garter throwing and the bouquet throwing. I skip all the boring parts. We should just do that here.
You mean quit?
No, just like hide in the bathroom during birthday parties.
Okay. Okay. That's cool. Cause when you said quit, I got scared. Cause I'm like,
no,
I got rent.
Don't get scared. I'm not trying to talk you into quitting. My God.
Okay.
I might quit. You don't have to quit with me. I know you're not going to quit. I know you're too scared.
Okay, so I see where we're going. We're just playing. We're bringing our real selves to this.
Yeah, I'm trying to. It's, you keep it small. You draw from reality. You know, at that point, I might try to push something a little more absurd and strange. Since you told me you're worried about quitting, I might try to pressure you to quit just to get a reaction out of you. But that's because we've already established a world and we're in it now.
And you,
the initial part where I'm just talking about how I don't like signing birthday cards and I don't like small talking, you know, that's all me trying to be my real self in that environment. And I'm trying to establish credibility with the audience that I'm not going to lie to them. And I think that's hard to do at first. I think that takes practice.
And then you also said something in this chapter, which I just love, because I've been using Zip Zaps Up probably 25 years. I just had my 25th anniversary of Zip Zaps Up, and you say doing Zip Zaps Up correctly. Can you explain that? Because I must have been doing it wrong for all these years.
Well, I'm sure you're not. I mean that. Some of these chapters are deliberately trying to be a little bit mischievous or whatever. But like, I think like Zip Zap Zop is best used as an exercise in keeping present. What I observed is I use Zip Zap Zop a lot. It's simple. Everybody knows that. It gets you going. I start all my classes with a Zip Zap Zop. And I notice how people, when they do it, they're surprised. Like when it comes around to them, very often people are startled. You know, somebody says zip to somebody, that person says zap to somebody, that person says zop. Then that person says zip to somebody and the person will kind of be startled and be like, oh, zap. And when I'm watching, I'm like, how can they be surprised? How could they be surprised? But people are frequently surprised during zip, zap, zop. So I feel like it's a good time to like I don't know, keep your head in the game. It's a good exercise, and just be very present and be ready for it to come to you at any moment. I say bend your knees a little bit, lean forward, and be very, very present. You know, make it like a Zen meditative thing where you are challenging yourself to be really there.
So the point is, when you teach it, what do you think the point is of Zip Zap Zop?
Passing energy and waking yourselves up and something easy to do, yes. But being present, keeping your head in the game. Don't think ahead. Don't sink into yourself. Don't just watch. You're part of it even when you are not the one doing something.
Only this podcast called Improv Nerd could we spend time talking about doing Zip Zap Zop correctly.
That's true.
Your next chapter, you encourage the improviser or the actor to be brave in their scenes.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Be brave is like is an acting challenge. Like, do the acting thing that you're scared of, which is different for everybody. You know, for somebody like me who didn't have a lot of experience and who's not really a big character guy, you know, doing a character is something that takes a little bravery, or doing an accent, or that, for me, that's being brave. If a scene requires that you dance a little bit, that requires some bravery because it looks a little foolish. For some people, being calm and still and quiet is being brave. You know, there's like musical theater people who love being like big and broad and charactery, and for them, being brave is the opposite. It's like be naturalistic and be small. But I think the audience can tell when you're doing something that's a little bit uncomfortable for you and they like it.
And then you also talk about in this chapter, which I found to be very interesting, you take the basic rules of improv, like don't ask questions, know your scene partner, avoid teaching and transaction scenes, and you boil it down to three things. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's called know, care, and say. Know like you know what's going on, and care like you care about it, and say like you say what you're doing. Say what you believe, say what you think. And I think that this came out of a lot of, I was thinking a lot about how one of the most common notes that you give as an improv teacher to people is to like say what you would say, you know, just do what you would naturally do, just play it real. And you know, that's a good note to give, but then a lot of times what people would do if they really are going to do what they really would do would be like avoid the drama of the scene. They would, you know, be silent, not care, walk away. And so I was like, yeah, what are the three exceptions to acting like we would act like? And it's like, I want you to act just like you would act. But you have to care about the situation, and you have to speak your mind, and you have to know what's going on.
Can you flush it out a little and give us an example?
Yeah. So this is, you know, if I'm teaching Jimmy Corrine to do improv, I always want to know what Jimmy Corrine really thinks, but I want him to always choose to know what's going on. So I don't want you to ever say, you know, if I walk into a scene with you and I'm like, hey man, all the Twinkies in this store are $100. What's going on? I don't want you to say, I don't know, my manager did that. I have no idea what's going on. Like that's, you know, or the company made us do that. I don't know why. Like that's a bad improv decision. I want you to know. I want you to have the reason available. You have to know. So, you know, the class, I don't want, you know, when people, it's very common for people in improv to say, this is my first day. I didn't decide that. I was forced to do it. Not my fault, not my problem, not my table. That's always a weak move. It's a braver move to say, I know why. I'm going to give you the reason why.
Because I could say, you know, I made a mistake. I overpriced them.
Yeah, that's good.
All
that's
right.
Good.
And that's the part.
That is I know.
Okay.
And I care means to be invested. So if I said, well, okay, they're $100. Just give, just charge me the regular price. I need you to care about it. You know, I need you to be like, no, you have to care. Like, no, I can't back down. I can't show weakness. I made the mistake. I got to live with it. You got to pay $100.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't buy them. But I'm not gonna. That price, I need to give it integrity. It has to mean something to your character. You have to give it stakes.
Could I also, in that situation, be like, you know what, I can't sell it to you for $100. I would just feel awful if I did that. So if you could come back tomorrow.
yeah, that's good. Okay. Yeah, as long as you're invested, because you're still invested.
But I also said no.
You said, your character said no, but you said yes to the reality. You said yes to the facts. You said yes to your previous statement of you being the person who put the price tag on there. You're also saying yes to being invested. The scene is moving forward and getting more absurd. So you're saying, you, the writer of the scene, are saying yes to the fun.
So we've got the no and the care. Now what's the say part of that?
Say part is you have to speak your mind. You have to always say out loud why you're doing things and be honest. No lying or very minimal lying. Improv scenes are the day that you tell the truth about the thing.
So I could say, you know, I did it because I was hoping they would fire me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Or I did it because I look down on people who buy Twinkies and I think that they shouldn't eat them. And I'm, you know, look at you. You don't eat well and I think you eat badly and I'm trying to force better habits for you.
Right.
Something you would never say to like a stranger, but I want you to say it in the improv scene.
Right. I couldn't say it to your face, but I noticed you've gained weight.
Yeah. So I'm pricing everything up to try to help you.
Right. And don't look at the Tostitos because those are $200.
Yeah, right. So like, no, care, and say are the three ways that we don't act like we normally do in real life. And if you say if you just act the way you would normally act, but you choose to know what's going on, you choose to care, and you choose to say it, that to me is what all those improv rules do. You know, avoid teaching scenes, avoid transaction scenes. They all just want you to know, care, and say.
And also in this chapter, you talk about a time where Amy Poehler really left an impression on you about this.
Oh yeah, she went. Amy at some point was coming around the New York theater a bunch. I think she was sort of she just had her first child, and I think she was feeling very motherly towards the theater. That's me just reading into the situation. I have no idea what was going on, but she was like coming around a bunch and like wanted to know what was going on at the school, and she wanted to meet with all the teachers, and everybody was like so excited to meet with Amy. So we had this big teacher meeting, and Amy showed up and like kind of like just gave some of her thoughts on improv teaching. Oh yeah, she also sat in and watched a couple of classes, which everybody was excited about.
And this is Amy Poehler after Saturday Night Live, right?
Yeah, this is like in 2011. This is like 5 years ago. So Parks and Rec is big hit on television, post SNL. Yeah, you know, like one of the funniest people ever, and also a very successful performer, writer. You know, we all loved her. And, you know, Amy was a charismatic, everybody loved Amy before she was famous. You know, she's like one of the most charismatic people, just even without professional credibility. She wants to meet with all the teachers. She's watching a couple classes and she meets with us. And one of the things she said was, don't ever let students quit. Like if they try to bail halfway through a scene, especially like in level one, you know, if they say like, oh, I can't think of what to say, or she goes, you got to nip that right in the bud. They're allowed to do bad scenes, quote unquote, bad scenes. You know, they're allowed to like break most improv rules, but they can't quit. Got to nip that right in the bud. And, you know, and Amy is so nice and nurturing as a teacher that I found it interesting to see the things that she was strict on. And that was one of the things she's very strict on. No quitting.
And why is that important?
I guess I'm going to, you know, I wish I'd asked her that, but I'm going to guess that it's one of those habits that once you let yourself do it, it really grows. And it like just, almost any other improv move you can come back from, right? Like if you say no in a scene, or if you choose not to care, or if you lower the stakes, or if you miss the game, almost anything else we can come back from by yes anding. But if you quit, if you just don't hit the ball back, it's over. The scene dies. I'm going to guess it's like just it's we need this house to stand up. You can't just take the wood away. So I think it's one of those habits that really becomes incredibly destructive if you give yourself that option.
You also talk about in this chapter about physical boundaries in classes and shows. And
oh,
you,
right.
And you say everyone has different boundaries.
Yeah.
Now, since I've changed this whole boundary thing has become, I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, it has really become to the forefront of teaching and improv. How do you tell improvisers today to navigate these boundaries?
This is a really tricky one, and I think I'm still working on this, so I don't think like I have the total answer, but my current approach is like, I want you to be brave as an actor. I want you to say yes to things in scenes that you wouldn't normally say yes to so that things can get absurd. However, I don't ever want you to feel uncomfortable. And so if you feel uncomfortable for any reason, you can say no in character and just give me a reason why you're saying no and it's okay. Just say no, give me a reason, and we'll yes and from there. And the reason that's okay is all improvisers of every level have listened to their gut when their gut tells them, my character wouldn't do that. And they say no pretty freely. And so I think even if you're a young improviser, listen to your gut. If your gut's like, that's too weird, my character wouldn't do it, all right, go ahead and listen to it. You might decide after the scene's over, I didn't have to say no there. I could have said yes. But that's okay. Like learning that you can say no is part of becoming a good improviser. I say just give me a reason why, and I'll be able to yes and your reason why, and the scene will be able to continue.
So if I came to you, we were doing a scene, and I wanted to give you a big bear hug, we're playing brothers, and you didn't want to do that, how would you respond to that?
I would say, hey, man, no, come on, don't do that. You know, I don't like being touched. I have a weird thing about intimacy. I don't like being touched, even by my brother. So I gave you a little reason why about my character. We could technically yes and that, you know, you could like give me a little history to that informs that, you know, that might become a game down the line, maybe. That's a good example because a hug is really no big deal. I would say that in most cases, a hug is fine. You know, it doesn't feel that intrusive to me, Will Hines, the teacher. But if the person doesn't want to do it, they can say no. If they give me a reason why, we'll be all right.
Okay, so let's go back to that scene for just a second. So you're like, I don't want to be hugged. You know, I don't like to be touched. Part of me would be like, okay, well, now here's the game. I'm going to touch him, and he's going to keep going away.
No.
Keep saying away. And also, stepping back from me because he doesn't want to be touched. Is that okay?
This is all comes down to intention. We're a company of actors. If you can tell that I'm truly uncomfortable, just out of courtesy, you shouldn't do it. If you think that I'm not really uncomfortable, it was just a gut instinct and this will be fun, then you should. Now, if you misread it, if you think, oh, this is just fun, I'm going to push this button, but I really mean it. Like, I got a weird thing about it. You didn't know that about me. I will double down hard. And you should be able to hear it in my voice. No, don't do that. And then you got to back off. I'll do it in character, you know. I'll just be like, no, man, I'm not kidding. We got to talk about something else. I'm really not into that. And then we move on.
Okay. You also, and maybe I'm a good example of a difficult person. You talk about working with difficult people. And what are some of the extreme behaviors? I actually love this part of the book. So I'm kind of.
Okay.
Of some of the just weird things that you've had to experience with people on your teams.
Yeah. So I just want to say this whole book, I didn't have a strong overall thesis. I coached or taught for a long time, and I'd accumulated all these little things I would say in classes, and I just wanted to get them all in one place. I don't even know why, for a legacy or just to make something. But my process for deciding if I would put something in the book was, I sat down and I was like, as far as I can tell, what are the things I learned that actually made me better at improv? Not like what I think the lessons should be. What are the actual lessons that I think helped me? And one of the, and that's when I realized, well, one of the things when I was younger is I was always willing to play with all the weirdos. I tried to make it work with lots of strange and difficult people, and that was one of the things that made me valuable. So that's how that chapter came to be. I was on a team called Monkey Dick. That was the name of the team. Sorry that it's such an offensive name. But we were all sort of like the leftover improvisers. We were people that were kind of liked as improvisers, but we didn't fit on any of the other teams. And some of us were sort of difficult, temperamental people, and we all just kind of got put together. And we were not a good team when we first got made, but we eventually did become a good team. And it was an example of yes-anding people that you don't really agree with or who don't do improv the way you want them to do it, and who sometimes are very difficult off stage. But by and large, we all, just through some luck of alchemy, learned to appreciate each other. And being on that team taught me sometimes you have to go along with a flow, even if it's not the way you want it to go.
Like you mentioned in the book, you know, somebody didn't want to pay for 3 months of coaching.
Right. There was this guy in a team, and he's ended up being a good friend of mine. He was a very charismatic performer, but he just wouldn't pay his share of rehearsal dues. He would, you know, I forget what the money was. It was something like we all had to pay $10 a week to cover the rehearsal space and pay for a coach. I think it was like right around there, 10 or 12. And he just wouldn't do it. Like he just wouldn't give the money. We also had a thing that if you missed rehearsal, you had to pay your share. And he definitely wouldn't pay for the ones where he wasn't there. He would just say, like, I don't have it right now. I'll get it next week, or like, and I just paid for him every week for 3 months. You know, I was paying my share and his share. And I was resentful about it. You know, I was mad about it, but he was a really good player. He was a really creative, inventive, and dynamic player. And I was learning a lot from him on stage. And I thought he was making the team better. And what I told myself was, well, I'll do this as long as I'm learning from him. And the moment I'm not, I'll ditch him. But I had a day job also. Like a lot of these guys didn't have day jobs. They were like truly kind of broke. I had a salary, so it wasn't as much of a stretch for me to do it. And I was kind of like, I don't mind it. I was kind of like, I like being on a team with this insane, irresponsible person, so I'm going to put up with it. Now, I'm not saying that everybody should put up with people who take advantage of them financially by any stretch. I don't mean that at all. But your own mileage may vary, but there will be times you have to put up with something in order for the experience of being around a creative person.
You know what also I found interesting in this book was you said that you were put on a team. And back then in the 90s, UCB was basically just starting out. But after four classes, you were put on a team. And you continued to take classes. Now, some people would say, look, I'm on a team. Screw that. I'm not going to pay. I'm not giving any more money to the theater. But you didn't.
That's right.
Why did you decide to do – why was it important to continue to take classes?
Well, for me, I was still getting something out of the classes. Like they were making me better. Like I was a very green player. I didn't feel very confident on stage. And the classes made me feel more confident and I was learning stuff. I mean, I still needed them and I still wanted them. And I was still getting something out of them. Like I would get better after each class. you know, eventually when I felt like there was the returns were more diminishing, I stopped. But you know, I had my improv practice with my team, and I wanted like two or three other things during the week that I could, with a coach, be learning. So I would take, you know, I would take a class, and these, you know, I was taking a class like with Ian, you know, like with Ian Roberts.
I
was taking, I mean, who's going to turn up their nose to take a class with this guy who's such a natural at it and who's worked so hard at it? It was like a great opportunity. I took a class with Ali Farinakian at this time, you know, and I really enjoyed that class. And I took a Besser class.
Matt Besser, sure.
I mean, these guys are great. Like, they're really interesting improvisers, and they were, I thought, all really good teachers. So to me, it was well worth it. Maybe I would have felt differently if I didn't respect the teachers.
Do you remember the time where you're like, oh my God, it's all coming together for me? The show or a scene?
I do write about one show in the book, in my prologue, that I felt a jump up. And it was after I'd been on a team for a year, and I was taking this acting class outside of UCB, like a monologue scene study class, you know, where you bring a monologue and have to, like, you prepare a monologue and do it for your acting class or whatever. And my acting class was a lot about being present and keeping it simple and being authentic. And so I was I was in a group game where we were all a bunch of Santa's elves or some silly improv group game. And all the elves, for some reason, they morphed into that they were elf robots and they were all shutting down. You know, in that improv, I don't even know how that happened. Just somebody made that decision and everybody copied it. And I peeled off and decided to re-enter as an evil villain who had sabotaged Santa's workshop. And I just remember saying, like, okay, I'm not going to think about game of the scene. I'm not going to think about heightening or a joke. I'm just going to try to be a villain. I'm just going to try to be a guy who hates Santa Claus and who is just so happy to see it all go wrong. And I just sort of got that feeling in my head, and I just walked in without thinking anything else about it. And everybody, I got a pretty good reaction on the walk-on. The scene went great, and I felt powerful like I had never felt before. I felt like, oh, this is acting. Like, I'm truly just playing, and I don't know what's going to happen. The audience doesn't know what's going to happen. I don't know what Santa Claus is going to say back to me. And I felt fucking great. Like, it's one of my favorite memories of all the improv I've ever done. And I was like, oh, and it was just doing it simply. I mean, it was a revelation.
The other thing I found very fascinating as I was reading your book was you use a lot of examples of scenes that you saw in shows or people did in your classes. And not only do you give credit, do you remember the people that did those scenes, you give them credit. How have you been able to do that?
Well, some scenes I have just always remembered. They really stuck in my brain as I was coming up, and I would repeat them as I taught and coached. So some of these examples are examples I've said in class for a long time. But most of the examples in the book, when I decided I was going to write a book and I started doing it, I mean, I had a blog for years, but I said, okay, I'm going to write a book in September of 2015. That's when I decided I was going to turn it into a book. I probably talked to you about it, Jimmy. I probably talked to you about it right around that time. And I started going to shows with a tape recorder and taping shows. And I would also tape classes that I was teaching surreptitiously, like without anybody's permission. But then I would, if I had a scene that I wanted to use, I would email the people and be like, look, I'm writing this book. I want examples. I transcribed your scene. Here it is. I would, in the email, I'd include the transcription. Can I include it? You know, this is what'll be in the book, or maybe a shorter version, but something like this. And some people would say, no, I don't feel comfortable with that, and I wouldn't do it. Most people said they were. And so I just did it.
Let's talk about the chapter you talk about being authentic.
Yeah.
And you say your first job is to ground the scene. Can you explain?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked about this, because this is something that I wished I could have said better. And I I still don't quite know how to say it. I wonder how you would put it, Jimmy. But it's something like your first job is to like make the, you know, whatever the choices are, whether you make them or somebody else makes them or the opening or the suggestion gives it to you or whatever. Your job is to make it feel realistic and truthful no matter what. And it's like you have to ground it. Like whatever the fact is, connect it to the reality of the scene. Okay, so for example, Jimmy, if I started a scene and I initiate by endowing you with something kind of crazy, you know, like I say, Jimmy, why did you unspool my toilet paper roll? Why did you unroll my toilet paper roll into a big pile? Right? That's my initiation. That's probably kind of a crazy one, but let's just say I do that.
Okay.
Your job is to put yourself in the situation of someone who just unspooled a toilet paper roll. You got to tell me why you did it. You have to connect truthfully to that moment and make it real for yourself and then tell me what you got.
So I would say something like, well, you're not paying any attention to me.
Yeah, that'd be perfect. You know, that feels like there's, a real germ of truth in there. That feels like it comes from a real place from you and like a little exaggerated. And I mean, that's a perfect answer. What's a bad answer is if you try to like think about it from the outside and you create some invented untruthful reason like my job pays me $100 every time I unspool a roll of toilet paper would be kind of weird and fake and complicated and strange, and that's not as helpful.
You also say, which I love when you the organic stuff. I love this.
Okay.
You say in improv, we say things before we even know we're doing it. And then can you elaborate on that?
Right. There's a section of the book it's called You Already Know the Real Why. And I think in improv you kind of react first and explain second. The explanation is really important, and saying why you're doing something is very often really valuable in an improv scene. And improv, we need improv characters to give their reasons for things way more often than people in real life are able to do. But you shouldn't like pick your reasons and then do your actions. You should like just react quickly without thinking. Just be in the flow of the scene, and then as you need, articulate the reasons why. So it's like react first, explain later. Is kind of like the order to do it.
Well, you explain in the book how you had to delve deep into one of your students to get the reason why, because the first couple answers seem to be very surfacey or almost jokey. Yeah.
Right. He was doing a scene. This is a really good student of mine, and he was doing a scene about two guys in Spain who had like Americans who were like hitchhiking through Europe, and they were in Spain and they were in Pamplona where there's the running of the bulls. And one of the characters says, we got to go to the running of the bulls tomorrow. And the other guy kind of like made this face, like that idea sort of grossed him out. He went, nah, man, I don't want to do that. And it was a really natural reaction. And I liked it. It was authentic and real and simple and truthful. And then I interrupted the scene and I was like, why don't you want to do it? And he thought I was scolding him for saying no. So he was like, he immediately corrected, oh, no, I want to do it. I want to go run with the bulls. And I was like, no, that's not what I meant. I like that you said no. I just want to know why. What's your reason behind it? And then he tried to invent some reason that wasn't true. Like, I forget what he said. Like, oh, my father was killed by running by a bull or something. And then I was like, no, I was like, you're overthinking it. I mean, just really, for real, why did you make that face? And he's like, oh, running with the bulls is douchey. It's like something frat guys do. And I was like, yeah, that's – I just need you to say that. I just need you to say that out loud. that's a great move. And I think that, I think that's hard to do. I think it takes a little practice to sort of like be aware of the reaction you're already really having. Just trap it and say it. I think that takes a little, that's not easy.
So how would you develop that muscle?
I'll be honest, I don't know. what I try to do is moments in class where it naturally happens, I'll just praise it. I'll just be like, I love that reason. That sounds like a very real reason. You know, I'll just try to praise the moments where it naturally happens so that maybe people will be encouraged to just do that. And I'll give that little speech that I just gave. I'll be like, I just want the real reasons for things. I don't want you to come up with crazy reasons. I just want you to say the actual normal reasons you have. I also tell people to be very opinionated in improv scenes. Like, having opinions and points of view is very valuable. So, like, you can be more opinionated than you are in real life. Let your opinions out. How would you do it? I feel like, Jimmy, you're a great teacher. How do you get people to be authentic with that kind of stuff, with their whys and their reasons?
I think it's just like what you said. First it's the teacher. So you work this way and I work this way. So we're looking for those things. And yeah. And so, you know, you're not going to get that from every teacher.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you just make it a priority and let them know you're looking for it. Also, I think they can feel it working like a nice, you know what else I'll try to do when those like magic moments in scenes come up where somebody gives a reaction to something and the reaction is so honest and truthful that everybody laughs. It's like such a moment of clarity. And I'll be like, the reason that's funny is we believe it. Like, it's so honest. You know, and I'll just be like, honesty is always great. Honesty always gets a laugh. I just try to praise the moments where it happens naturally and hope that they can then sort of encourage their scenes toward those moments afterwards.
And I think sometimes, too, that I see in my classes, especially when people are starting out, the small honesty things, like, I didn't hear what you said, or could you, you know, I didn't understand what you said. All those things that can help. I mean, that can help you get to the bigger honesty. But I think sometimes when people start out, if they don't hear something or they don't understand something, they just want to act like, you know,
they got it. Yeah,
they got it. And then they're totally disconnected.
I know. It's very tricky. I mean, I'm sympathetic to them. It's very hard. Like, a lot of these improv guidelines, they do contradict each other. You know, I want you to act normally, but I want you to know and care and say. I want you to give me your honest opinion, but I want you to say yes to everything that you're endowed with. But I don't want you to be uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable, I want you to push back. Like, there's no one formula that works every single line.
Right. And
speaking of
contradiction, now you've told people to be present and to be authentic, and now you're throwing the big anvil in, which is be funny.
Yeah. be funny is a real dangerous one. And the reason why I put it basically second to last is I think you shouldn't worry about it when you're first learning improv. But I do think at some point it is disingenuous to tell people always don't be funny. I think at some point you have to cop to, we want the show to be funny, and funny people will be more successful than unfunny people. And let's talk about it. You know, like, let's I tell a story in there about Matt Besser that I really love. And it's where he basically called us out for avoiding the word funny and when we talked about improv. And I really loved it. Can I tell that story real
quick?
Please
do.
This was a Del Close marathon, like around 2005, I think. And I was a teacher, but I was pretty a new teacher at UCB. And Besser had moved to Los Angeles, and I was still in New York. but he was coming back for DCM and he was teaching some workshops. And I had taken him, but I wanted to see him again because I just thought I really admire him as a teacher, and he was my boss now. And I was like, well, I want to see his workshop. And I audited it, and he came in and he started off asking everybody why they liked improv. And everybody was giving like your sort of expected reasons, like, oh, you know, it teaches me to say yes. You know, I like that it rewards truthful things, and I like that it goes to really crazy places and you never know where it's going to go. It makes me think on my feet, which are all fine answers. But then, you know, Besser, in a very Besser sort of dismissive tone, was like, nobody wants to be funny. Nobody's doing it to be funny. Nobody saw a bunch of funny people doing it and was like, I want to be funny. And he just was like, it was hilarious. And we were, I think somebody even was like, I want to be funny. And Besser like pointed at them and was like, see, this guy, you all do. He's like, you know, what's wrong with saying we want our scenes to be funny? That's not bad to want that. And I loved it. You know, I think he's right. Like, if you are funny at the expense of being committed, or if you're fake and you force it, that's bad. But that doesn't mean that you still don't wish for the scene to be comedic, you know?
So how do I take all of these things, be authentic, be present, and then bring the game of the scene, which is, you know, certainly very, you know, popular method taught at UCB. How do I marry all of these things?
It's really hard. I think it's just a, I think it's a question of priority. Like, I think of these things as a pyramid. Game is the top level. The very bottom level is like being present and being, you know, saying yes, and good acting. Good acting is like the bottom level. And then above that is sort of like being truthful and grounded and having wise. And then above that is game of the scene. And I think as long as you prioritize it that way, you'll be all right. Like, if you don't know what the game is, but you are acting well, your scene will probably still be pretty good. If you have a good game, but you throw away all your acting, the scene's going to die. You know, you can't have the top level of the pyramid without the other levels below it. So I think it's just like, if I don't know what the game is, but I know the who, what, where, and I'm acting well, and I'm giving good, and I'm saying out loud my reasons for doing things, the scene will probably be pretty good.
And the thing I also like about the book is you give definitions right at the beginning of the book. And so for you, what does game of the scene mean?
Game of the scene is the funny part. It is the whatever part of the scene is making you laugh. That's the game you're playing. And you want to just do more of that and heighten it as you go. You know, earlier when we were talking, and you know, you said we decided that your guy at the 7-Eleven had priced things high because he noticed I was fat. And you've also priced the Tostitos high. They're $200. Now we're playing a game together. We're playing the game of what else has this guy done to make me lose weight? And it's a simple little game, and it probably can't go on for too long, but we can play it for two or three moves and have a little time with it and then move on.
So I could, you know, you can't leave unless you ride the recumbent bike for 10 minutes or,
yeah, exactly.
You know,
I love that. You know what I mean? Or like, you know, I tell me what you've eaten today. I'll enter it into a calorie counter. And if you've had enough, we can get you a treat or something like that.
Okay. So there's no right, one right game.
No, just like I like to keep it really. It's just whatever is funny to you, then I just keep it going for a little bit. That's game of the scene to me. You know, there's no 100% rule on comedy. Usually it is an unusual thing with an explanation behind it. You know, usually something weird has happened, and there is an explanation. And once I have the unusual thing and the explanation, usually that's what I need to keep it going, but not always.
So it's in the example that we did earlier, we've priced the Twinkies at $100. I did it
that's
because
unusual.
I saw and the explanation is because I saw you gaining weight.
That's right. So now we've got enough to keep. Just the Twinkies being $100 isn't enough. I need to know what the story is with it. Then I've got it. But you know, sometimes the game is like I'm not above anything that's fun. Like, I like little meta games sometimes. I saw a scene just Monday night with a Herald team out here, and there was a guy who was playing a character who wanted to impress everybody that he had invented this very technical software thing for Google. But, like, nobody understood it, so nobody was impressed with him. But he kept trying to impress everybody that he had done this cool technical thing. But then in the midst of the scene, he rests his feet. He sits down and pretends to rest his feet on a desk, but there's no desk, so his feet are just hanging in the air. And his team kept asking him to put his feet on higher and higher pieces of furniture just to pimp him out, just to pimp out the actor and make him have to sit more uncomfortably. And they gave up the normal game, and they were just doing this dumb game of torturing their friend by making him sit in weirder and weirder positions. And it was funny. And I'm like, well, that's a meta game that's not too committed or truthful, but it's really fun, and I'm glad they did it. And I like them for being funny, and, you know, just do that for a couple minutes. I don't mind that for a little diversion.
Well, and I'm sure their instinct, what it's the same. I mean, it's a game is a game, and they probably were working off, oh, the audience noticed something that was a little odd, that, you know, and they just kept heightening it.
Yeah, you know, you're it's okay to be just to have a little fun with each other, little, you know, we call them like a side game. You know, we'll get back to the real game in a second. Let's have fun with this little side game for a moment. Just having fun, messing with each other. I think that's a good time.
Now, I love the chapter about being healthy, which is really about taking care of yourself. Get enough sleep, eat healthy. And you also talk about in this chapter the dreaded improv rut. Now, it seems to me –
Well, I just want to say that I'm glad you're asking about this chapter because I thought about you when I wrote this chapter. Like, you've talked a lot about like emotional challenges of doing improv, and I think that's like a huge part of being good at improv is managing your own feelings, like just the weird ego, pride, insecurity that gets activated when you're doing performance. I mean, I think that's almost just as important as having talent is – I mean, just as important as having comedic talent is having emotional talent of managing yourself.
Yeah, because you're dealing with so many different personalities.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the most frequent things you talk about when you're coming up in improv is like, I don't feel like I'm doing well. I mean, it's one of the most common – you know, that was a bad show. I did so bad. I mean, people are beating themselves up all the time, but always, but especially when they're first coming up.
And I don't know if you get this. I haven't gotten this as much, but when I was teaching at the bigger institutions, I would get people coming up to me and saying, Will, do you think I have what it takes?
Yeah. I have that happen now and then. It's a weird situation because the truth is I usually won't think they have it. I mean, there's just so many people. It's very rare, but it's just very rare for me to see anybody and think like they definitely, I mean, it happens sometimes, but there's very, very few people where I'm like, they're a star. And so the real answer is I don't know. Like, I don't know if you work at it and you believe it enough, you probably do. It's hard to say.
Well, it's hard to say too. Like if they're just doing it for the 1 or 2 years, you know, it's almost like come and ask me that question in 10 years, you know.
Yeah, I would say 3 years is the number, I think. Like, I definitely don't know during your first year. But if you've done it for three, I bet you we have an idea of what kind of improviser you would be, I think. Not that you still don't have upside, but I'll probably see what kind of shape you are.
Right.
That's what kind of energy you are.
Well, that's because UCB is much more competitive. Chicago, it's like, 20 years. Come back to me in 20 years.
Yeah.
But yeah. In this chapter about being healthy and the improv rut, it seems to me that they're related.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. What two things are related?
Taking care of yourself. And getting enough sleep and emotionally taking care of, feelings, and then getting in an improv rut. Where is the correlation between those two? Or is it just in my head?
No, I think you're right. Like, if you're not doing the first one, that's where the rut comes from. You'll think that it's because of not following some improv rule, but you just need to take better emotional care of yourself and that rut will go away.
Because you say in the book, like, if you're in a rut, what's the best thing to get out of it?
A good show. I mean, I try to be honest in the book. I try to not say what I think somebody should say or whatever. And the truth is, if I have a bad show, you know, I've done improv long enough that I can shake it off. But I won't feel good until I've had a good show. That is the truth. I actually got that from a baseball book. I read this baseball memoir called Ball 4 by Jim Bouton.
Yes.
Did you ever hear of it?
Yes.
I really love that book. I love baseball and I love that book. And it's his sort of diary of being a pitcher for the Seattle Pilots in the late 60s, this sort of like expansion team that wasn't doing so good. And he was like later in his career trying to like get a couple more years out of his career. And he talks about having a bad game, and he's like, nothing fixes a bad game until you have a good one. Like, you just can't shake it until you've had a good game. And I read that, and I was like, that's true about improv. Like, that's the only real fix for it.
So how do you, if you're in the improv rut, and the cure is to have a good show, what do you have to do to get to that good show?
I mean, it's like one of these like mind games you have to play with yourself. Like, okay, yeah, you're not really going to feel good till you have a good show. But if all you think about is having a good show, ironically, you'll never have it. So you sort of have to let go of that so that you can get it and just focus on being a little kind to yourself, have taken a break, get back on the horse as soon as you can. You know, set a nice, specific, doable goal for yourself for the next show and be proud if you do it. You know, like, I'm going to initiate a scene, or I'm not going to initiate any scenes. I'm just going to practice reacting or whatever. But I have an email in there from Zach Woods that Zach Woods sent to a friend of mine. And it was this really kind, compassionate email that basically said, like, it happens to everybody. Maybe take a break from improv, go see a movie, go hang out with friends, and then come back to it refreshed, and you'll have that good show that you need. I don't know. What's your answer to it?
Well, I think what you said is, I think a lot of times it's because we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And I know for me in the past, it's like, oh, I got to get that good show. And like you said, the more you put on it, the more you're not going
to
get
it. Harder it is to get.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, you know, the taking a break, being nice to yourself, it usually happens because I don't have a life. It's all about improv and I'm making it really important. And you talk about this in the book too, especially in this chapter. It's like, it's not tied to, and I think maybe Zach in his email talked about it as well. It's not tied to your self-worth. So if you're not a shitty person,
right.
If you have a bad show. And I think it's getting space. And the other thing is, and you talked about it, is making small goals for yourself in the show. I'm going to start the first scene. I'm going to You know, I'm going to initiate a game if I'm doing a Herald.
I'm going to be more emotionally committed, maybe, or like I'm going to improve my specifics or something like that.
And that has nothing to do with the audience reaction. And then you can leave going, I did that goal. I achieved that goal for myself. And the other thing I do is, and I got this from a great improviser, Bill Baylor. And basically, I would call him up before shows and like, I'm in a rut or whatever. And he'd say, just go and act. Act it. Don't worry about being funny. Don't worry. Just go up and act, which means react and play it real. And most of the times that helps me get out of the rut because I'm just putting way too much pressure on myself.
That is good advice.
You tell us not to quit during a rut. Why is that?
Well, I just think because they happen to everybody. And so, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. And I think you'll regret it. Like, I just think like it just – you will feel better if you can just hold on. Like, you absolutely – it'll come around sooner than you think. And I've been doing it a long time and – I've had as much validation, I think, as you can have from a very competitive improv theater. And I still have shows where I walk out being like, I'm bad at this. I'm bad at this. I'm a fraud. But I just know enough to be like, don't listen to that. In like a day, you'll feel better, or even a couple days. Yeah, so just distract myself until that voice kind of quiets down.
And I think the progress for me has been that voice, you know, which used to last for a week, now only lasts maybe for a couple hours, maybe sometimes till the morning. But it used to last for a long time.
Yeah, I've learned to, I mean, I've done like lots of like therapy stuff and 12-step stuff and like meditation stuff, and a lot of self-helpy things will give you strategies for dealing with like your own internal negative voices. And one of the ones I like is this is not in my book, but the Adult Children of Alcoholics big book, their sort of like big book for that program. I haven't done that program, but I read that book just because I read a lot of self-helpy stuff. And they talk about like integrating your character defects instead of like punishing yourself for your character defects, like accepting your quote unquote destructive habits as part of you and just like observing that they, I'm not saying it as well as it was said in the book, but like the point is when I hear that negative voice say you're bad, you're a fraud, I treat my brain like it's a board of directors. And one of the board of directors is just really sour and negative. And I'm not going to kick him off the board, but he doesn't get the final vote. That's all.
And he's certainly not going to be invited to the Christmas party.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
The other thing, I love how you end the book about – and I think this is pretty true for Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles. And that is this whole concept of, am I wasting my time? Doing improv. Improv's going to get me nowhere. How did that come about, that chapter?
Well, I had a blog. I guess I still do. I might go back to it. But I've had an improv blog for a long time. And somebody sent in an email that asked about a friend of mine who had just gotten on SNL. And they were like, you know, who cares about improv? Like, all that matters is if you – what you do to get these jobs, you know? Do you think that improv was kind of a waste of time and he probably should have started doing sketch a lot earlier? Something like that. And it just made me realize, I was like, well, I don't know. Like, that seems like a strange question. Like, you don't live your life for what it gets you in 10 years. Like, you do it because you like it now. And that, like, it made me realize, like, well, yeah, you know, it's good to have goals and to work towards things for sure. But, like, I mean, ultimately, all we have is the day that we're in. So if you do improv, it's because you like improv.
But you were in a similar situation as I was. And so, in back in 1999, UCB is an unknown quantity. Long form improvisation in New York is an unknown quantity. You're starting, you're part of this movement. And I would imagine, just like when I started back in the late 80s here in Chicago, except for, you know, wanting to get to Second City, there wasn't that same pressure or those expectations on improv as it was when you started.
Yeah. It was more of a, you're saying like how when each of us started,
yes,
the scene was so small that it was just kind of a thing you did for its own sake.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yes. Like, was that true?
Yeah,
like, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Was that true when you started back in 1999?
Absolutely. Like nobody in the UCB had jobs. Even the UCB themselves, the four of them, they did have a show on Comedy Central, but it wasn't like a huge hit show. They weren't like enormous celebrities, not to like belittle their show. Like there were not like agents in industry walking around the UCB theater, and you went to Herald Night and watched the Herald. It was just about who's good on stage. The world was no bigger than that. There was sort of an amorphous, wouldn't it be great to be like a comedian who was like had a job and was getting paid and could write things and be on TV. But that was a faraway dream. Like what was palpably in front of you was like, how do I do a good first beat? How do I start a scene well? And we were all just sort of fully occupied with doing good shows that week, you know, or the next week. And I don't even remember people talking that much about anything else until years later.
Do you remember when it changed?
It was gradual. Like, I remember that people started to talk about it in whispers. Like, I'd be on a Herald team, and two of the people would have gotten – were like writing a thing and submitting it to a show, you know, they for something like, you know, to write for Conan O'Brien shows from like the mid 2000s. And, you know, we'd be like, how did you get to submit to a show? How did you even get that opportunity? And it'd be like, oh, so-and-so knew so-and-so and recommended me, you know, or like, and then like commercial agents started coming around and asking people to audition for commercials. Then Comedy Central was in, you know, was in New York, and people started doing like promos. And then being asked to write for like the Man Show or whatever was on Comedy Central, like in 2004 or earlier. It was very gradual. And then, I don't know, over the course of 5 years, it just seemed like everybody was talking about agents and managers. And I guess like once the top of the top people at the UCB community started getting work, you know, like Jason Mantzoukas, Paul Scheer, Rob Hubel, Rob Corddry, like Rob Corddry getting on The Daily Show, Amy getting SNL. I don't know, just one by one, it started to kind of bleed throughout the whole community. It's like, oh, professional success is possible.
And as a teacher, for somebody who was starting there before they had all that notoriety, did you see things change in the classroom, or how did you try to maintain what you taught, and not like, oh, you're coming here, you know, as some sort of, you know, road to fame?
Well, yeah, it got bigger. There's more people, so that's weird. That changes things. Yeah, there's a higher incidence of like professional people who have like type A people who have come here with a goal, and it used to be a lot more just like shambly weirdos. So there's more people who show up like ready to take notes and who have read all the books and like heard all the podcasts and know everybody's name, you know. Whereas like back when I took my classes, I didn't know anything about Chicago improv. I think I'd read Truth in Comedy, but I didn't know who the family was, you know, or like JTS Brown or Jazz Freddy or any of the old groups. You were on Jazz Freddy, right?
Yes. So when you got
yeah, like I didn't
go on.
When I took classes, we had no knowledge of. We were not burdened by the past, and it was less important than just like this is fun. We're going to do it now, and the way I approach it as a teacher is like when I came up, it was like improv was a thing of personal growth to me that made me into the person I want to be and made my life more fun. So I teach improv as if that's what you want. That might not be true, but that's the only way I can think of improv. I teach it to you so that it can like change your personality and make your life more fun. If you choose to do something professional with it, that's none of my business.
We've got to wrap this up, and we always ask the same question. You've been on the podcast before. We actually did it in Boise, Idaho.
Yeah,
is that right? Yeah,
that's
that was like
right, yeah.
like that was like was it 3 or 4 years ago?
I think it was 2 years ago. I think. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
At the Boise. Oh, I can't even remember. Do you remember what the name of the festival was? Oh, I feel.
It might have been the Boise Comedy Festival. Improv and stand-up was going on.
Right. And the question is, what would you tell somebody starting out in improv today? What one piece of advice would you give them?
I would say be a good actor. That's what I would say.
Will Hines, thank you so much for being our guest. His book is How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth. You can get it. What is the best way to get it?
However you want to get it. You can get it from my website, which is improvnonsense.com, or Amazon. Either those two ways are great.
So check that out. Thanks again for being our guest, Will.
Thanks, Jimmy.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can, and I want to thank our guest, Will Hines, and check out his new book, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth. You can purchase it at improvnonsense.com. That's improvnonsense.com or at amazon.com. I'd also like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, Sam Bowers, who's the director of Improv Nerd, and my wife, Lauren Corain, who helps prepare me with research and does all the helping me with the questions. So I want to thank them as well. As you know, you can follow us on social media. So go to our Facebook page and our Improv Nerd Facebook page and like us because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, follow us on Twitter, which is improv_nerd, and then go to our YouTube channel and subscribe. You will see clips from our live shows and also when we go and we do interviews. So you get to see my facial expressions and you get to see them improvise. It's really great. And Dan Schiffmacher did a great job with that. We're also blessed enough to be part of a wonderful podcast collective out of Los Angeles called feralaudio.com. Some of the most popular, hilarious, and innovative podcasts are happening on feralaudio.com, so check that out. I want to thank you guys for listening, and until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you fuck.